In today's episode, I speak with Beverly Banahene, who's the founder and CEO of Overploy. Overploy is a tool I discovered on Product Hunt because it's launching soon, which makes it possible for your employees to post stuff for your company. But if they are doing pretty well and they are like generating some traffic, you can give them money for their success. And it's like a little bit gamified so that like the person who gets the most views gets the most money. I like the idea. So I invited Beverly. It was like a really fun and like energetic podcast, which I wasn't expecting because I'm a little ill. I hope you're okay with my voice this time. And I would say, let's get it started. Okay, welcome back to another episode of the Digital Economics podcast. Today, I speak with Beverly Banahene, who's the founder and CEO of Overploy. Happy to have you on the podcast today. Can you quickly explain what Overploy does?
Yes, so thank you for having me. Overploy is an employee-generated content platform. So we turn companies' employees into content creators, powered by AI, and we pay them for their content.
How did you, or maybe before we speak about how you came up with the idea, maybe we dive a little bit in your life. So you also have a marketing background, that's right?
Yeah, so I studied marketing and economics at university. And then I went on to work at General Electric, looking after the marketing communications there. And then I've got a pretty big background in employee communications. So I worked in employee communications at Virgin Media, Sky, O2. And then my last role was at Salary Finance, where I looked after employee communications for, we were client facing. So we had worked with several brands, like Aldi was one of my clients, JD Sports, Currys, lots of high street ASOS, high street retailers. So.
Can you explain a little bit your job? Like I think sometimes it's crazy if I explain my parents what kind of jobs exist for. What does a head of employee communications person do? So how did it work?
So in my role, I kind of transitioned. So prior to working at Salary Finance, in my role, I would work on campaigns that would require employee engagement. So employee comms, internal communications. So that was communicating the company's proposition, mission, values, and then also doing employee activations internally. So we would create campaigns, we would do events for employees as well. And then I would also work with different departments. I'd work with the marketing. I was actually worked with the commercial team. So I worked with the marketing teams. And what I was doing was creating a lot of employee campaigns. So marketing maybe wants employees to be featured in an ad. And then I'd work with the employees to be able to kind of bring that to life. So that was kind of my role. So I worked on loads of really fun things like game shows, TV shows, festivals, events. And it was all about like helping with employee engagement so that employees are happy to work there and they understand the mission, understand what the purpose of the business was. And then also just using them for storytelling as well.
I think the using them for storytelling part is quite interesting. Why would someone do that? So I mean, of course, it's a job. If your boss asks you to post something on LinkedIn, maybe you're gonna do it. I guess like this is not working really with pressure. It's more working like if someone really wants to post stuff about what they are doing in their own company. So what was the incentive for people to post?
The incentive, so we had different ones. So a lot of employees just post super organically because, you know, you spend so much time of your life at work. And sometimes there's some cool things happening. So that would happen organically if there was a campaign or something really cool that you liked or you wanted to talk to customers about, you know, employees would do that. And then some of the stuff we would actually encourage them to create content. But it was always really hard, like you said. Why? What's in it for me? And like kind of cringe, like I don't want to. There's the people who are like content creators that get it and they want to, like they love creating content and they understand the benefits in doing it. And then there's people who you have to kind of convince, which was harder to do. And we would incentivize using vouchers. We would incentivize just by featuring them or leaderboards. But I guess the kind of pain point that came was it was really hard to incentivize employees. And then it's also like you don't know who the employees are that are the ones who naturally, organically create content and understand it. And then the other ones who were pulling their teeth. And maybe if you don't want to do it, we're not going to try and pressure you. So it's always such a struggle for people in my role to actually find employees to engage and actually create content because, you know, there's that incentive piece. And also, I just don't really want to do this.
I am happy and proud to announce the sponsor of today's episode. Working with startups and tech companies has taught me a big lesson. Finding the right tools for your team can really change your business. That's why I'm excited about Deel, the all-in-one platform for global teams. That's DEEL. Deel makes it simple for companies managing an international team to seamlessly hire, onboard, and pay both global employees and contractors. They handle all of the paperwork, exchange foreign salaries into local ones, and ensure compliance with local regulations. Deel is designed with the needs of a global workforce in mind. Seamless contract signing, easy expense uploads, in-platform time off management, and more. Plus, its customer support team is available 24/7, no matter what time zone. Ready to see how Deel can transform your global workforce operations? Head to deel.com to book a demo today. That's deel.com. Back to the episode. And that's probably an opinion which I shouldn't say publicly, but probably the people who are like really into like, yeah, I want to post a lot of things, are sometimes less interesting than the people who are like really nerdy in something. And who are definitely not into posting. So I want to read something from a developer or from a search engine optimization genius or someone who found like a hack for Google paid ads or something. And I don't want to read like the 20th story about like my cat has birthday and that's what I learned for my career out of it. Stories on LinkedIn, which I find really cringe sometimes.
Lot of the content on LinkedIn is super cringe. And I think like the way employee advocacy kind of works now is that you have platforms where a company will create like boilerplate content and you just repost it and maybe say a couple of words. And it's like, it's super boring. It's kind of cringy. And also like people don't really want to be sold to, but what audiences do engage with is the diversity of like, you know, you've got your SEO nerd and you've got someone who is like really into like, I don't know, nuclear science. And it's just giving your brand a personality because people buy from people, they don't buy from brands. And sometimes just having that affinity to your brand, like being liked and seeing that there's real people there, it keeps your brand top of mind. So you don't have to always be selling, you know, it's just creating content and talking about the brand and being a representative of that brand as well, but in your own voice and like bringing out those quirks. If you are super nerdy about like this hack and you want to share it, then yeah, definitely do that.
So regarding that, I think I really like this when people are not selling on LinkedIn, but are like, okay, I created this cool Excel sheet or this Google Docs, which is really helpful for my daily work. Here is a free access for everyone to my Google Docs. Yeah. And that's so fucking helpful. And it's sometimes like really easy going because the company doesn't care. It's not like private information. But I think, yeah, there's right now not really incentive for people to post these kind of things. I think we're having already the perfect transition now. Like, why did you start at Overplay? Can you say a few words towards it?
So my last role, I actually worked on a client-facing base. I wasn't in a company. It was a company, but we worked with retail and restaurant brands and consumer-facing brands. And we would launch financial well-being programs for these brands. So we would create, it was a employee financial well-being where you could basically advance your pay, or get affordable loans that are deducted from your pay. So we would launch with all of these clients and we would do re-engagement campaigns to let employees know. And a huge part of my role was around financial education. So I would create content. And this was at the height of the cost of living crisis. This is when it had just become really bad. And we were having problems in the UK around energy prices that had just skyrocketed through the roof. And so a lot of the clients, a lot of the, you know, high street retailers were coming to us and asking us, like, we really need you to help us. Like, we need content on, like, how people can better make their pay last, you know, because people are really struggling. We were hearing stories of people, you know, fainting on the shop floor because they couldn't afford to eat, not making it into their shift because they couldn't afford the transport, and just like really horrible stories. And just like, just generally no one, like a standard paycheck is just not really enough anymore. So my content was really limited to, like, you know, cancel your Netflix, don't get that Starbucks latte, you know, those type of things, which are just like financial relief measures. But there was nothing I could really talk about for employees about how you can increase your income, because it was a conflict of interest. You know, I couldn't say, you know, just ask for extra shifts, ask for, you know, a pay rise, because I mean, the employer would not put that on their channels. They wouldn't want me to tell the employees to do that. So, and I have always had a side hustle. I've always been doing multiple things. I'm just like a hustler. So I, you know, hearing people struggling, I would want to say, you know, isn't there something you can do on the side rather than borrowing money? Can you make money on the side? And then obviously I knew that we were, in my previous roles, doing employee campaigns. They really worked very well. And we would pay if we could, but it was just really administratively really hard to pay employees outside of payroll for these type of tasks. So we had to give them vouchers, and vouchers don't hold the same weight as like money. So... And so that's kind of where the idea kind of came from. It was like, oh, what could employees do that's mutually beneficial? The employer would be happy to pay them and they could make extra money. And like, what kind of unique position do they have as an employee that they could capitalize on to make extra cash? And that's where the idea came from. And yeah, then the idea for Overployed was kind of born from that.
How did you solve a problem that it's hard to pay like employees extra cash? Yeah. Because I think that's no matter if you're in Germany or in UK or somewhere else in the world, that's always like a problem. That it's like, if people don't have like a self-employment, then they cannot invoice. And then it's hard to give them extra cash if it's more than like a 50 euro like gas station voucher.
Yeah, so how we work is that we are an intermediary. So the way we work is a two-way platform. So our customer is the marketing manager, the social media manager, CMO, and they would go on to Overploy and put budget on a challenge for employees to create content around. They give us that budget and then we disseminate it to the employees, and employees are paid on impression. So they're paid by Overploy. And so we are an intermediary. It's kind of like a gig platform that's internal. So it's like having an internal Upwork where, you know, we're paying the employees. So you don't have to worry about, you know, the tax implications because it's outside and we're the ones that are kind of the go-between.
And how do you solve this for yourself? Because I mean, still same problem. If people don't invoice, you can just not send them randomly money, right?
So the way the platform works is that you have a challenge, you take part in the challenge, and there's milestones. So for example, if I'm the marketing manager at, you know, McDonald's, and I want to create a employee generated content challenge around, like, you know, what's your favorite milkshake, and or making or behind the scenes, you know, of like setting up for the day, and I'm inviting employees to take part in this challenge, and the max that you can make on this challenge is $100 or £100 or €100, and you start earning from 5k views, and the max at $100 is 200k views. So along that spectrum, we pay out employees based on how many views until the budget runs down or when the deadline of the campaign is closed. So everyone gets paid different amounts of money. So the reason why that's important as well is because sometimes marketing managers will choose their favorite piece of content, but there's no way of knowing whether that's going to perform or not. Whereas what we do is we kind of democratize that and we say, let everyone take part. If it performs really well, you'll do really well. And if it doesn't perform as well, you will just get compensated based on where your content lands. So then, yeah, that's how we're able to pay them. So we tally up the views and we give you your pay according to their views. We don't have to invoice. It's just like, well, in the UK anyway, it's just how gig platforms perform now is that, you know, you would work on an Upwork or an Fiverr. And it's upon you as the employee to self-declare. We do have like side hustle calculators on our platforms as well. So we don't leave employees worse off. But there's no invoicing. It's just a budget that's paid by the employer. And then we pay the employees for their content.
But officially, they would have to register a business, right?
No, I don't know how it works in Berlin, but in the UK, on most places, you don't. I mean, loads of people have side hustles. It's not a business. If you want to operate it as a business, you can do that, but it would be on you as the individual to decide how you wanted to be paid. If you want to be paid as an individual and it's a side hustle, and then you'd have to self-declare the money that you make from the side hustle, but it's kind of like how a freelancer works basically.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And I'm almost 100% sure, like in Germany, like with the first euro you earn, then you have like to open at least like a small, like not a limited company, but like Einzelunternehmen, which is hard to translate now. But so you have to declare to the Finanzamt, to the financial institute that you made some earnings. That is my income. That's what I paid. And you like have to register like a mini company, something like this. Interesting.
Is there like a side hustle culture in Germany as well? Like lots of people have side hustles.
Not really.
Okay.
I would say it's really atypical because, I mean, it's kind of risky to like build a side hustle, and Germans, I think, really love their security.
Okay.
And have insurance for everything. I think it's one of the stereotypes which is actually true, that we love our insurances. And
okay.
I think of course we're like people like giving everything and working a lot, but these people normally even like create like a limited or create like a formal business. I think this gig worker thing is not really existing. And I think even if you like deliver pizza for 300 euros or something, when you have to open, either you're like a 450 employee, which is like a special thing, but when you're an employee, or you have to invoice the Lieferando or whatever, Deliveroo. In UK, they don't have to invoice. And I think obviously like in Germany, there would be also ways to solve it. Companies are coming to you using your SaaS platform for like, registering. That's an idea we want to push, or that's a link we want to push. And then you say on your website, turn your employees into AI-powered content creators. So I put like a link or an idea I want to push on social media. How do you then support like AI-powered content creators?
Yeah, so the way it works is that when you sign up, we do ask you like a kind of a profile. You create your profile. We have the profile of the actual company, their name, a little bit about them. And then that's set up when the manager signs up. And then the manager invites employees to join the platform so that they can see the challenges that they have open. And then you as an employee, when you sign up, you kind of talk about the content niches that you create, if you're already a creator, or the content niches that you're super passionate about or interested in. You tell us your gender, your age, you know, just also we do a content style analysis AI. So we kind of ask you, like, what are some of the key phrases that you kind of say in day to day? We ask you, you know, like a little bit about you, how you speak, you know, how you would explain something, your communication style. That content analysis plus the data from your profile when you create your profile. Every time there's a challenge, our AI uses the information in the challenge, so what the employee is asking you to do, and also information about the brand. And then it also asks you, we do a brainstorm, so it's an AI script brainstorm. So we'll ask you, are you going to film this in store? Are you going to film this at home with your family? Is there going to be someone else in the video with you? Are you going to involve your colleagues? And then what it does is it'll create a content script. So it does, aside from the script, it also gives you a bit of an idea for pre-production, post-production. So, like, you know, you should film it like this. Maybe this is a sequence you could do. And then it will give you a little bit of an outline of what you can cover in your video. And it also takes into account, like, what's the duration? How many seconds is this video going to be? How can you make sure you have a really strong hook? So you're learning, but in your own style, because we didn't want it to be like super generic and everyone has the same type of script. It will kind of give you this idea, jump off to kind of start with. And then also kind of key thing as well is that the AI also does brand safety, because obviously some of the brands will be really, you know, kind of concerned that the employees are not going to say anything crazy or off brand. So that's how we use AI to kind of power employees, because some people won't know how to create content. And so this is also an opportunity to learn a new skill as well.
And like from an employer side, I set up the campaign, and then I also define, okay, that is the money which you can win if you're like the most successful running this campaign, or how do you like so is this like really flexible? Can the employer put every money and every achievement, because you said before 200,000 views for 100 euros? I think I don't know anyone in a company who has like 200,000 followers on any platform.
It's not followers, it's views. So like if it's all based on impressions. So what we're trying to do is, you know, what you would normally do is you'd pay a influencer that has a huge following a whole bunch of money. And we're saying, okay, our employees are micro influencers. If we aggregate all of their views for one campaign, then it's the same kind of impact, because it's all different views and it's diverse. So the way it works is that, yeah, so you have a max payout. So, if you've got a large organization, you know, with like 1,000 employees, and some of them will be really good content creators and some of them maybe will have a following. So that's kind of where it gives you the flexibility with, like, we're assuming most of them are going to be micro influencers. They're not going to get, you know, maybe even if no one maxes out to 200,000 views, the people who get 10 or, you know, 5, they'll get a bit of money. And then until the budget is completely finished. So that's kind of how it works. So you would create a challenge, and then you'd pick a budget. So maybe you say, okay, 5 grand. And that equates to loads of challenge. Like the max payout is 250 euro for 250,000 views. And you can start earning from 1,000 views. So if you get 1,000 view, then you get 10 euros. If you get 5, then you get 50. This is terrible maths, but hopefully I'm explaining. Okay. So like it varies. So like, I might just, you know, you might be brilliant, you know, you're great, you've got this podcast, you're really good at content, and you might max out and make your 250,000 views and get the 250 euros. And I might just do, like, my video maybe is not that great. I didn't have good lighting. I wasn't, you know, it wasn't super engaging. So mine doesn't get that many views on TikTok, and I only get, 3,000 views. So I only make 30 euros. And so that's how it works. So everyone who takes part in the challenge, it's fair. You know, if you don't make any views, then you're not going to make any money. But then for me as the marketing person or the employer, I've got, through all of these little, you know, videos, I've now got millions of views on my one campaign. So it kind of spreads it out and makes it more fair. And I'm getting more bang for my buck. I'm getting, you know, more, making my budget go further mm-hmm. by doing it mm-hmm. that way.
Yeah, I'm surprised by these huge numbers, but I think probably like there's a huge difference between the fashion niche or like more a B2C niche than B2B, where people are like, oh, I have 300 followers.
Yeah.
Or 600 views or something like this. It's crazy. I would say because there are not many like B2B people who are interested like in the newest SaaS shit in like their specific niche. Okay, cool. I was checking the pricing. It's 10 British pounds per year if you're under 10 employees. Is this correct, or is it like 10 euros per user per year, or is it 10 pound per user per year, or 10 pound per month per user per year? Or it seems a little low.
Yeah,
but I mean, I guess that's a good thing.
It's not that, it's not low. So if you okay. The way it works is it's free for the first 10 users. So if you want to try it out, you can try it out with 10 employees for free. And that's Overploy Bit Pro. And then Overploy Business is £10 per employee. And then if it's over 10, so if you go to 11 employees, then it now turns to £6.71. So £6.71 times 11 would be your cost. And then it's charged per employee. So like if you've got 20 it's on a scale. And then you've got the two plans if you want pro or business, and business is a bit more expensive. And then we also have more consultation, which is where we will actually create a strategy for you. And maybe if you wanted a more bespoke white label version of the platform as well, we can also do that.
Are you profitable? Because I that's why I'm asking. To me, like, it seems like a really cool business model and a really nice business idea. And I really see the value in that. I slowly get into like getting an understanding that there are like B2B influencers who get like 10,000 euros for like a 30-second TikTok video, which is insane. And out of this world. I wonder, I see the value, etc. Do you think you can hold these prices forever, or is it more like for the beginning, like as a marketing thing, and at some point you will raise the prices?
We are actually quite well priced in terms of where we are. Most of who our customer is we go for large organizations, so we have volume. We're very much like going for enterprise SaaS. So like currently what works for us and what works for the brand and where they would really need us is somebody who has at least 50 employees. So, you know, the 10 employees is kind of for you to test it out. But if you're going to have loads of people creating content, it doesn't really work for really small businesses. It's more for larger businesses. And that's where, you know, that's where our pricing kind of makes sense, is that we're not expecting smaller companies. They can use it. That's the idea, actually, is that we can grow with you. Like as your business grows, you've enjoyed the benefits of having it for really cheaply. But then where we are able to really make majority of our revenue and our profit is from the larger companies. And we've kind of scaled in that way. And we also we're very new as well. I mean, we just recently launched. We've got one client so far. That's a huge client, though. They have 10,000 employees.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Yeah.
Then it makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. So if we get, you know, more of those, then it can definitely be quite profitable in that way. So I think the pricing where we are now is we've kind of, I don't see us raising pricing, just because, like I said, with like the enterprise stuff, it gets really expensive. And
I absolutely was not thinking about companies with 10,000 employees, but I mean, probably exist these huge companies. Again, like in the B2B niche, like companies are really often smaller. And like I don't know, like there are huge companies with 10 people or 50 or maybe like a few hundred people, but a few thousand people is insane. But obviously B2C like needs this because you need support people, you need salespeople, you need like so many things like I guess like a Walmart or like another big supermarket has like millions of employees.
And you know, the funny thing is actually Walmart does do this. They have got their own platform that they use. They've got an app that they use, which we like, it was kind of like, it was good validation when we were actually putting the idea together because they were doing something very similar. And Walmart is like one of the largest employers in the world. So,
Are you completely bootstrapped at the moment?
We have actually got some funding. So we've raised some funding, but like not a lot. At the beginning of this year. So really been doing Overploy since November last year. So it's not been a full year yet. We raised a little bit of funding, but we are going to be fundraising in September. So next month.
Do you already know kind of the numbers, what you like try to accomplish, what you want to raise?
What I want to raise is 500,000 for our pre-seed. And like do like an angel round and that should take us because we we want to expand like it's enterprise sales, so the sales cycles are pretty long, so that's what we're looking to do.
If you get the 500k, what will be the main things you want to invest in?
Definitely the platform. So like we need to actually build like a proper robust platform, so for the build, and then also just to ramp us up our sales process, so like having people in the team to really do that business development, and then also content as well. So sales and marketing, and a huge part of it will go towards product as well.
But I guess like runway wise, probably like if you get 500k, then like if you get like normal senior like expensive developers and it's probably five people for 1 year. So I guess the money is just planned for like accomplishing 1 year, making in this year already like lots of revenue as well, and then like the goal is like 12 months after to do the second round or a
do
series.
You know
a.
What? I really don't want to do like a second round. I'm really focused. I'm really focused on profitability. Like what we have now, the platform that we have now, will last us quite a long time. We can get quite a few clients onto it. We will still need to build, you know, a more robust platform because this is, you know, initial idea. And the reason why I kind of delayed just going for the pre-seed round is because I wanted to get a customer, I wanted to get traction, try and be a little bit profitable, and then raise in that way. So that runway will give us 24 months runway with the 500K. And I'm not planning to like get a huge team, but like, you know, solid team, really good people, good engineers that can build the product, and then like, hustle as much as I can. If I have to raise money, I will, but like my desire is not to just do the endless fundraising rounds. I mean, I did start at having a VC, and I'm not sure if I want to go down the VC route. You can build a huge business, not VC standard of huge, but you can build a solid business with like a little bit of, you know, angel funding and trying to maximize profitability, especially now the way the economy is. For me, it's not just about growth. I really want to create a sustainable business. If it takes slower, that's fine, I don't mind. And if it's I don't want to be slow, but like if we have to kind of be scrappy, I don't mind doing that.
Yeah, I really understand, but my feeling is like talking to lots of founders. I mean, there's always the official part, and then there's the unofficial part. And I would say like two or three founders are really, really happy with VC because they get the power to build like great stuff. But one out of three people is like, yeah, we shouldn't have done that. We were like actually just too lazy to do the hard work. And now we have the trouble that we're losing the freedom to like do it our own way. And I hear that sometimes.
I agree.
But just in the unofficial part of the podcast.
That's the reason why you become an entrepreneur, you know, like I'm not like, I know I'm still accountable to my clients and my employee, all this type of stuff, but I want the freedom. And like, I've spoken to so many founders. I've spoken to founders who've created monster businesses, and their investors drive them crazy. They're just like, it's really sad, and they don't own very much of their business when it's all said and done, even though, you know, you might have a huge business, but like, you don't own very much. So, I mean, I'd rather be more sustainable. So,
who else is involved right now? So you're the only full-time person right now on the project?
Yeah, it's just me. I have interns. I have technical people who've helped me to build the platform as well. I've got loads of like a network of people and mentors and all this kind of stuff. But for full-time, it's just me.
But like talking about technical people, how did you solve it? I mean, you have a technology platform now, and you yourself are a marketing person, if I understand that correct. So you're not a developer. How did you build like a technology platform? Because I think that's interesting for people who are maybe non-technical.
Yeah. So I have someone who helped me to build the platform as well. So they build the platform. I work with them. They're part of like the co-founding team. They're not full-time. They have a full-time job. And then also I've kind of learned how to code myself. So I do have technical knowledge in that sense. Not a huge amount, but I really wanted to understand. I think product is so important if you're going to have a tech business. Like, I don't want to sit somewhere and be bamboozled. And, you know, I want to be able to contribute to conversations. So I've really learned a lot to be able to talk to engineers and understand the product myself. Like, I really understand how the product works. I can fix things myself on the platform as well. So,
oh, crazy. Okay. So you really have access to the code, have GitHub.
Yeah, exactly.
So Visual Studio Code, etc.
Yeah, exactly. So I've been able to do that, and yeah, it's been really important to me. So that and also, like, obviously now that I've got the traction, it just gives me better access to be able to get the funding to like actually get like a secure team, or secure the team that I have full time, to kind of be like, this is what we've done with just me and a couple of people that I've managed to convince to come and do this crazy idea with me. Like, now give me my money. And also I wanted that for my own conviction as well, to be able to say like, it's that, like, the product is super validated now, and I'm like, I'm all in, and I know that like, if I take your money, I'm going to be able to do what I need to do with it, and, you know, it's a good.
But that's so cool. I think there are lots of people like dribbling around this technical part and being like, yeah, okay, I'm gonna outsource this completely, and I don't touch it, and I don't know how it works, and I forgot my password. Can you send me my password? And I think that's quite dangerous if there's no
massive technology knowledge. the key thing about me is I'm a control freak. I can never like that. I'm too far too controlling. It's not even a choice. This is just like a really big part of my personality. So I was like, I want to understand. I'm not somebody who can be hands off. I want to know. I need to know everything that's happening in this business, and I'm not unapologetic about that. Like, I don't care if you find me annoying. I need to know.
But how did you get into that? Because I think it's like intuitive to learn programming. If you do it like in university, it's intuitive. Like in school, if you try to build your own website and stuff, but it's different to build like a website or like a SaaS business. How did you taught yourself to do programming?
I'm not like a complete coder. I know very basic code, and I've used a lot of tools, a lot of AI, a lot of, you know, integrations and APIs and all this type of stuff. And to be honest with you, now it's like there's so much help, and I'm just a naturally curious person. Like I can go into a rabbit hole. I don't have loads of funding, and I don't have money to pay these people, and I want to do this. So that's along with like technology and having a curious mind, you're gonna figure it out. You know, do you know what I mean? Like if you're determined enough, you'll figure it out. And I there's been times where I'm just like, this is so hard. Like, what the hell am I doing? This is not my area of specialty as well, but I needed to, like, now I don't mind if someone else does it. I understand. I don't want to be able to have educated conversations with people and feel like, I don't want to feel cheated. Like I said, and I'm just like super controlling as well. So like, you're going to have to explain to me. Oh, I'm going to have to, I need to understand what you're doing.
Yeah, I had a situation, I think 4 years ago in my old company, where like one manager of mine came to me and was like shyly asking, can you explain me Git versioning? And I was so impressed by that, because I think it's like something where you need to cut down your ego ask such a question. But it was so helpful, like in the long run, because the conversation was so smoothly afterwards. Because I think it's just like hard to manage like a technical team without technical knowledge. Exactly. And it was just like an easy 30-minute conversation. And afterwards, like, I mean, it's not important to know everything. It's just important to know like the shit which is needed to have like a conversation which is like kind of productive, to not like talk around and not knowing like what are we talking about.
I agree. I think if you think about founders these days as well, like, I mean, you can be really dangerous if you know a little bit of code, and the same thing with coders as well, with engineers. I mean, you can't be an engineer, and especially if you're a solo entrepreneur, and just say, no, I don't do marketing, I don't know how to do marketing, I'm not doing marketing, that's not going to work. You know, you need to, I mean, it's good to have co-founders. But if you're going to be a solo founder, you're going to need to understand. And if you don't have anyone in your team that's technical, that can, you are the person who is going to have to learn this. Otherwise, you need to go and find a co-founder. And I don't have a co-founder, so that kind of left me in a spot where I need to find a co-founder. Yeah. But finding a co-founder is super hard. Having a relationship with somebody, like, so having that trust. Understanding their work ethic and the quality of their work as well. And I didn't want to put my idea on hold until I found a co-founder. All of this just led me to the space of like, well, what are you going to do? You're going to have to figure this out. And then
But cool that you're saying like, okay, obviously it would be better to have a co-founder, but that shouldn't stop me. And I will find someone at some point.
Once you have something that is working, like everything just becomes a little bit more easier. I didn't want to raise money until I had traction. I didn't want to try and find a co-founder before I started, because I was just like, let me start and then the people will come, the money will come. But, do you know what I mean? I know this is not probably the ideal way to do things, but that was my rationale.
I think it's the ideal way to do things, because people are always waiting for the perfect moment to come.
Yeah, you can't do that. It's not coming. Yeah, it's not coming.
It's like people who wait for the perfect situation to get children, and then they are like, I need a house, I need the perfect job, whatever. Like, come on. Like my parents didn't have like any of that. And
exactly. And they figured it out. And I turned out okay as well.
I think sometimes it's okay to like do the thing without the plan, and the plan comes itself.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, also this podcast, like a friend I had a really interesting conversation. He was like, I would never start like a podcast like that without any concept and any plan. But that's the thing. Like I started the podcast, and slowly I find my niche and what I find interesting. I think if I have like episode 500, then it will be a good podcast. Right now, it's a nice podcast, which I enjoy.
Yeah.
But it will be professional at some point. I'm confident about it.
The thing is, you know what? You just have to start. Everyone has to start. The student or the teacher has once been the student. Like, we all have to start from somewhere. And so, you know, if this is it, and you can't wait for that perfect moment, like you're saying, and you just got to get on with it.
Yeah. I 100% so much agree.
So
you're searching for 500K from an angel investor, and you're searching for a co-founder. Anything else, like if someone is listening, which would be cool if people reach out to you?
Yeah.
Besides, if they are interested for such a software tool.
That is what I was going to say. Covered. If you've got employees and, you know, if you're consumer facing, you have frontline employees. Consumer facing or even B2B, you know, like everyone needs content these days, and personal brand is becoming a huge thing. People, you know, brand owned channels, we want to see human beings, we want more connection. And, you know, I think employee generated content is going to be a huge thing. So if you are looking for a platform and looking for ways to do this, then yeah, you know, you can use our platform, you can try it out. It's free for the first 10 users. If you scale, then we'll scale with you.
One last question. I think you have like such a cool startup vibe, like let's do it. What are like the main learnings you would give to someone who wants to start a company?
big
question.
But I think if you want to start something, just start. You don't know what you're doing, you're going to make mistakes. This is like my fourth or fifth business, you know. The sooner you start, the quicker you'll get the stripes on your back, and like eventually you'll figure it out, you know. Or some people just get it straight away. But I think there's always a lot of failure before you actually make it and become successful. I think you should definitely start, and I think being an entrepreneur is about people. And you know, you have to be good with people, and just enjoy it as much as you can, trust. I think the biggest lesson I've learned is to trust my gut, trust my instincts. But I think that's because I failed a lot and I've learned from my mistakes. That's why I kind of say you should just start, because all of that learning will help you. And then once you get to a certain point, you become an expert, or you do know what you're doing. And then you need to start trusting yourself and not think about the mistakes that you've made, and think of yourself more as an expert, but then still have the humility to know that sometimes you will be wrong. So I think that the biggest thing for me is to trust your gut. I think I have a very good gut. And if you know that your gut is not broken and you do have sense, then you should listen to it. But if you don't, then go and get experience first, because it takes time to understand how to do things and have some
I mean, like being good at something comes from experience, and experience often comes from failing a million times until you know how to do it. Cool. Thank you so much for being today on the podcast. I really appreciate it, and I of course will support your product and launch, and I wish you all the best, and I'm excited for the next years to come for Overploy. That's quite exciting, your journey, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for listening. As always, if you liked the episode, please like the podcast, share it with friends. I hope my voice was okay. I feel a little sorry for that. I felt good enough to do a podcast, and I actually really enjoyed it and feel more energetic now. Have a lovely day, lovely week, and see you next time. Bye-bye.